For tonight's feature on The Last Late Show, we'll take a look at the 1986 classic Vamp, as producer Don P. Borcher struggles to keep up with the 80s diva of fashion, movies, and music, Grace Jones. We'll hear from Grace about her process to create the alluring, iconic Egyptian vampire known only as Katrina. And hell on the set of that production as the crew attempts to deal with her nocturnal schedule, vanishing acts, unexpected trips to Paris, and even a run-in with a fugitive from the FBI's 10 most wanted list. That's right, you do not want to miss this one. Stay tuned here tonight on The Last Late Show. You're tuned to The Last Late Show, where we tore the back lot of some of the greatest horror and sci-fi films in cinematic history. Bringing more than just reviews, we bring you the story behind the story. A backstage pass into the spills behind the chills and the teams behind the screams. I'm your host, Jonathan Rain.
Today, I was nearly hung. I got into a fight with a psychotic albino. I met a human pincushion in the bathroom. I ate a cockroach, my best friend disappears, and then I'm nearly assassinated by a runaway elevator. I've had a bad day.
Two fraternity pledges travel to the big city and wind up at a sleazy bar in search of a stripper for the night's frat party, unaware that the entire bar is run, occupied, and infested with vampires. Starring Chris Makepeace, Robert Russler, Dee Dee Pfeiffer, Gary Getty Watanabe from such 80s classics as 16 Candles, Gremlins 2, The New Batch, and Sandy Baron, who played the unforgettable Jack Klompas in the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld. Welcome to tonight's edition of The Last Late Show, and thanks for joining us as we take a look at the 1986 classic, Vamp. Now, if this plot sounds familiar, no, you're not crazy. Neither of you hit overload on horror cons and fan conspiracies. We have it from Don P. Borchers himself that this Venus flytrap strategy was reimagined for Robert Rodriguez's 1996 blockbuster hit From Dusk Till Dawn, with George Clooney stepping into the role of Robert Russler as the cool guy. Quentin Tarantino would step in for Chris Makepeace, adding a dash of Tarantino crazy. And Salma Hayek would pick up where Grace Jones left off as the seductive temptress vampire stripper that absolutely brings the house to a standstill with her riveting performance. Now, best friends would be swapped for brothers, and college students would be swapped for bank robbers. But the end result would still be the same, as both teams have to marshal their resources and pull out all the stops in an effort to escape with their lives. So let's put this baby to bed once and for all. Let's end the hotly contested debate between fans, the which came first, the chicken or the egg, whether or not From Dusk Till Dawn is a clone, an actual reimagining of Don P. Borcher's Vamp. So here's your chance as early subscribers of The Last Late Show to become that guru at the next HorrorCon in the obscure vintage 1980s Motel Hell t-shirt that dazzles the crowd with the breadth of their behind-the-scenes knowledge. Listen close.
I get a phone call one day from Mr. Robert Kurtzman, who I know from Doppelganger, and he says, I have a script that you have to produce. It's called From Dusk Till Dawn. It's written by a guy named Quentin Tarantino. I said, well, let me take a look. And Reservoir Dogs was out, and Pulp Fiction was being made, and this was going to be set up as his follow-up. So nobody knew what Pulp Fiction was going to be doing just yet. So I brought it over to Trimark Pictures, Roger Burlidge, and they were very happy to make a deal, and I was setting the thing up lickety-split. And as fast as that happened, Quentin's people, and I was going to do it for $2 million. As fast as that happened, Quentin's people figured out how to do, how to go into the marketplace and raise $8 million for the project. So I get another phone call from Robert Kurtzman and says, look, the reason why we brought it to you, quite frankly, is we were in the movie theater watching Vamp. And after Quentin saw Vamp, he says, I got this great idea for a movie, From Dusk Till Dawn. And then we went off and he developed it, and it was appropriate for us to bring it to you. We, quite frankly, don't want to get sued for plagiarism.
And there you have it, directly from the mouth of Don P. Borchers himself.
You're lying! I know!
Yep, sounds like a HorrorCon already. Now, if you're interested in hearing these interviews in their entirety, you're going to want to take a look at the Vamp Special Edition Blu-ray DVD available right now on Amazon for $25.49. Now, it should be noted when we originally began producing this episode, that very same DVD was $14.99. However, it does contain special edition contents, including One of Those Nights, The Making of Vamp, a brand new documentary featuring interviews with cast and crew, director Richard Wank, Robert Russler, Didi Pfeiffer, Getty Watanabe, Sandy Baron, and producer Don P. Borchers. It also contains a blooper reel, for those of you out there that are interested in that, and an image gallery, as well as Richard Wank's 1979 celebrated short film, Dracula Bites the Big Apple Now. This is the very same film that brought Richard Wank to the attention of producer Don P. Borchers through a mutual acquaintance, Carol Olson. So you're going to want to check that out. That is on the DVD, and you are getting it for free. It also comes in a reversible sleeve featuring original and newly commissioned artwork by the Twins of Evil.
The devil has sent me, Twins of Evil.
No, not Mary and Madeline Collinson from the Hammer film of the same name. Though I have been hard-pressed to turn up information on this company, though I've done quite an extensive search online. So if anyone out there has any additional artwork by the Twins of Evil or knows how to get in touch with this company, please feel free to let us know on the Last Late Show website. Now, we've saved the best for last, and I hope you're sitting down for this. But the Vamp Special Edition DVD actually contains rehearsal footage of the monstrous sofa transformation scene between Grace Jones and Robert Russler. That's right, the pivotal point that shifted the movie and took us in a whole new direction, cementing Vamp as one of the four pillars of the great vampire films of the 1980s. So there you have it. You are going to want to see that as they work out all of the gory details. Grace Jones actually rehearses this scene with none other than the director, Richard Wank. And that in itself is all I'm going to say on that matter, but it is definitely worth taking a look at. You're also going to want to take a look at the life, legacy, and legend of Don P. Borchers, available right now on the Don P. Borchers YouTube channel, as well as various Vamp special featurettes that appear to be from previous VHS releases. We've scoured the internet to compile various sources of information to bring you the complete backstory on the creation of this vampire classic. So there you have it. Let's jump ahead. Directed by Richard Wank, who's went on to direct some of the most famous features in modern cinema, such as 16 Blocks in 2006, The Expendables 2, The Equalizer in 2014 with Denzel Washington, and the horrible remake of The Magnificent Seven in 2016 that we all could have done without. Now, Donald P. Borchers would serve as producer on Vamp, coming up with the title and the parameters, college students, strippers, and vampires. Richard Wank would come up with the story in a matter of months, and they were off to the races. Initially envisioning Jerry Lewis for the role of club manager, eventually played by Sandy Baron, once that fell through, they decided to play up the vampire angle, going for star power and settling on Grace Jones, who was fresh off the success of Conan the Destroyer and A View to a Kill with Roger Moore. Despite the immense gravitational field of Jones' growing star power, Vamp failed to pull more moviegoers into its orbit, coming in at just under $2.2 million its opening weekend and a total gross of $4.9 million during its entire theatrical run on a production budget of $3.3 million. Now, even by horror movie standards, $1.6 million is nothing to write home to Transylvania about. Top movie critics of the time, Siskel and Ebert, would have this to say. Now, we were lucky to find this clip as the years have not been kind to the 1986 audio. We did our best here at the Last Late Show to clean it up a bit. Let's listen in.
Well, if you've seen the ad for Vamp, you probably have the impression that the movie stars Grace Jones, but actually, all she has is a fairly predictable supporting role. The real stars of the movie are Chris Makepeace and Sandy Baron, who play a couple of college kids who want to hire a stripper for a fraternity initiation, and they pay a visit to the wrong nightclub. Grace Jones is a dancer in the nightclub, which is actually a front for a ring of vampires who drink the blood of unsuspecting customers. Although Vamp is basically a vampire movie and a thriller, The movie that it reminded me of the most is a little surprising. That would be Martin Scorsese's film, After Hours, which is also about a young yuppie who's trapped in an all-night big city nightmare. Vamp has something of the same style, plus vampires, and it has something of the same low-key, offbeat comic approach. In fact, it has some very good moments, especially in the way it develops the relationship between those two college kids after one of them becomes a vampire. But like so many movies these days, it believes that chase scenes and thriller cliches are going to act as a substitute for real imagination by the filmmakers. Vamp has some good stuff in it, but not enough.
No, not enough exactly. I think your criticism is right on target. Here they had a cute relationship between the two guys with lots of jokes being traded, and then they have Grace Jones. If they had just kept this a three-cornered piece, if you will, they could have made a very good, entertaining movie. Instead, they take us into this bar and give lots of screen time to a whole bunch of vampires that we don't care about that look like the cast-offs who couldn't make it in Dawn of the Dead series. Mm-hmm. And so much time is spent with these slugs and all these guys and the chases in the night that the movie runs away from itself. It loses the energy, and I don't think, I think your point initially about Grace Jones being advertised in this film, that's misleading advertising in my opinion.
Yeah, it's not really a Grace Jones movie. The movie has moments, little flashes of wit, of brilliance, of little imagination.
And lots of big flashes.
And then lots of big flashes of cliches. Is it just me? I mean, it seems like almost every thriller movie these days ends with the same 15 minutes. I've seen it before. It's the same setup and the same payoff.
If they're going to create these characters, why not develop them all the way? Why not go through the characters all the way? You know, right now, Karate Kid is a very hot film. Mm-hmm. We don't think it's that great a film, Karate Kid 2. But at least it stayed with its characters. It had the brains to do that.
That's right.
Did you catch that? It wasn't Chris Makepeace and Sandy Baron. It was Chris Makepeace and Robert Ressler. Which just goes to show you how much attention these highbrow critics paid to horror films. Anyway, the hits would just keep coming as critics would raise the stakes, almost in a race to see who could leave the worst review on Vamp. The next entry would be by Sid Smith, entertainment writer of Chicago Tribune, July 17th, 1986. You'll love this one. In an article titled, Grace Jones is the chief victim as Vamp tries to spoof vampires. You can't fault the makers of Vamp for lack of creative effort. The idea was to entrap the vampire legend in a campy send-up. One not set in Transylvania, mind you, but in the seediest of strip joints in a grimy Los Angeles back alley. With Grace Jones as star vampire, what great fun it all might have been. Unfortunately, the laughs are strained, and many of the effects are ludicrous. The filmmakers couldn't come up with enough good plot and dialogue to fill in the gaps between their little satirical stab. In fact, it's a good thing the movie's back alley setting is colorful and atmospheric. The whole picture after a while becomes little more than an extended chase scene throughout the dingy neon pink and green lit corridors. Even Jones, in an assortment of psycho-sick costumes and facial contortions, can't sustain interest. The story involves Keith, Chris Makepeace, the schoolyard victim and my bodyguard, and A.J. Robert Ressler, a couple of college students angling for admission into the best fraternity on campus. Budding con artists, they consider the nerd-like members of the frat house a joke, but a superior alternative to the lunatic infantilism of dormitory life. So they promise to deliver a live stripper at the fraternity's upcoming bash and set off with an even nerdier nerd, Getty Watanabe, who owns a car to find a G-string pro. They do. But when AJ slips backstage to make his offer, Jones, without uttering a word, seduces him, turns into a vampire, and literally bites a chunk out of his neck. Thus begins a rather claustrophobic odyssey as Keith tries to recover his buddy in the nightclub, in its surrounding neighborhood, where roving punks aggravate Keith's troubles, and in the underground sewer system, where the club vamps keep their cobweb coffins. He's helped by Amaretto, Dee Dee Pfeiffer, about the only club worker who isn't a vampire, providing the picture's love interest. Makepeace and Ressler manage to bring a hip convincing ease to their role, and one thought line in the movie has promise. In a touch of black comedy, Sandy Baron is a club owner, justifies running a vampire outfit in the club as a socially beneficial enterprise. Nobody needs the dregs who show up there. But Jones is poorly used. Robbed of dialogue, she's reduced to hissing and spitting noises. And while her first strip number in white makeup and startling red attire is amusingly funky, her later coiled bikini wear and frequent makeup jobs reminiscent of The Howling manage what she avoids in her performance art-tinged concerts. They make her look ridiculous. More problematic still is the slapdash way director-screenwriter Richard Wank shifts from bad action shots to bad humor. Some of the underground scenes seem to have been stocked with sets from a shuttered amusement park. And as for the jokes? Well, when the boy's car first goes out of control, going into a spin and stopping was clearly a spooky new dimension. Here's the punchline. I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. Oh, would that we were, Toto. Would that we only were. And that would be Sid Smith of the Chicago Tribune would give Vamp 1.5 stars, believe it or not. It says many review Damp Camp. Now, this actually can be found on the Chicago Tribune website. We were thinking about posting it to the Last Late Show's website. Don't know if we'll be able to do that. But if we can, we'll have it there for you guys to take a look at. It is indeed a scathing review, but it is not the worst because just 6 days later, Paul Anastasio, the Washington Post staff writer, would say an effort to outdo Sid Smith, but he clearly outdo Sid Smith when he attempts to rope in the then sitting Attorney General of the United States. Okay. And an article titled Vamp, Tooth and Consequences. Somehow, when a young collegian toward the opening of Vamp paged to a sex magazine and uttered the cri de coeur, that's French, hey guys, Booborama, I knew that this was not some place I wanted to be for the next 90 minutes. For those of you out there who find life is something besides too short, Vamp tells the story of three buddies who, as part of their fraternity initiation, go off to hire a stripper for a party later that night. They fall into some kind of time warp and end up in a nightmare world designed like a second-rate nightclub and populated by vampires. But these young people are none too swift, which may be the only point of realism in Vamp, so they continue on their quest. At a bump and grindery, they are captivated by a stripper, Grace Jones, who appears to have borrowed her bikini from a junked appliance and her red fright wig from Bozo the Clown. You know, I'm sorry. That's priceless. In our hero's minds, this is sexy. One of them goes backstage to hire her and ends up with a neck full of fangs. This tragic hickey is the first... I'm sorry. Let's take it from the top, guys. This tragic hickey is the tip-off that something is dreadfully awry. Vamp is stupid and crude, and, yes, Ed Meese, dirty. Jones, who became famous for a hairdo that made her look like the USS Enterprise, here dons a hairdo that more closely resembles a football. And if her performance is any indication, carries the same contents inside. Wow, there you are, Paul Anastasio. Staff writer, The Washington Post, would leave that review July 23rd, 1986. An article titled Vamp, Tooth and Consequences. We will include that link as well. That is a short, to the point. That's a blunt object murder right there, what you're looking at, what they call blunt force trauma. That's that's absolutely blunt force trauma, guys. We are going to leave that on the website. You will be able to follow that link to the Washington Post website, and if you personally want a copy of that. As a matter of fact, I have a wonderful little piece of software that helps with the Last Late Show. It's I believe it's newspapers.com, and what you can do is you can go there, and they actually have screenshots, almost like you guys that are probably around my age or older, and I am 50, actually remembers when we had this thing called microfiche, and you would have to actually go to the library and they would set you up on the machine. And it was sort of like a giant Viewmaster view. You know, you would go there, you guys that remember the Viewmaster view from the 70s. It was actually like a giant Viewmaster view. And you would get in there and you could, you know, look into this thing and it'd set you up for the newspapers you're looking for the year that you had to look through. And you'd scroll through this thing that was actually like snapshots, like these mini, these tiny little like micro snapshots of newspapers from times past. Well, that's almost like what newspapers.com is, but it's actually digital. So now you can go there and actually see the newspapers and then you can download it. Now, if you want to get really fancy, what I did for my son's college project is we actually went to Amazon and they have a newsprint paper that you can get that actually looks like, and that's what you should type in, newsprint paper, and it actually looks like newspaper. And it's actually sheets, you know, 8x11, and you can put them in your printer. So you can actually go to newspapers.com. You can start with a free membership. And this is not a plug, by the way. We're getting nothing out of this. You won't even find a link to newspapers.com on the Last Late Show website. This is not a plug. I'm just letting you know. But you can go there, and you can pull up these articles. And then when you pull up these articles, you can print it out. So you can print it out probably on a free membership. You can print this out on newsprint paper and it'll literally look just like the newspaper article. And then you could cut it out. You could frame it if you want to, you know, maybe put it around your, maybe you might get that special edition of Vamp, off of Amazon, you know, with the cover done by Twins of Evil, and maybe take that artwork, done by Twins of Evil. And perhaps you could put that. Now, that would be awesome. You could put that in perhaps a picture, maybe with those kind of reviews around it, maybe frame the whole thing. Now, that would actually look quite awesome. So there you go. A little project for you guys that like to really dive in when it comes to your horror films. Maybe really sink your teeth in. Pun intended. And do something a little fancy there. These articles would be available, will be available, including this. This crime of blunt force trauma in which Paul Anastasio attempted to rope in Ed Meese there, who was the sitting attorney general. And yeah, we have a little information on that. Now, for those of you who didn't catch Anastasio's Ed Meese reference, don't worry. Edwin Meese III actually served as the 75th U.S. attorney general for then sitting president Ronald Reagan. Now, he was tasked with forming a committee to investigate the harmful effects of pornography. And out of that came something that's commonly referred to as the Meese Report, which was a document spanning some 1,900 pages. Okay. Now, this document actually was divided into five parts, 35 chapters, and covered most of the aspects of the pornographic industry. Including the history of pornography and its First Amendment protections, as well as the harmful effects of pornography in the United States and the ties of pornography to organized crime. Now, you have to understand that this was way before the invention of the Internet as we know it, as the World Wide Web. Sure, they did the best they could with what they had. However, if you know what that means, then you are part of Ed Meese's worst nightmare, which would be something around nowadays, a 25,000 page report. And Anastasio in that scathing piece actually tried to reference Vamp to some sort of bloody pornographic assault on the senses. So, you know, there you go. And that brings us to where we are now. But the real question is, where does Vamp sit today? With its cult status among us horror aficionados, let's take a look. Well, Rotten Tomatoes, the tomato meter, which consists of professional critic reviews, gives Vamp a 40% on the moist meter. And the audience score, totaling something over 2,500 reviews, gives Vamp 49%. So that's almost evenly split. Let's jump over to Amazon Prime and see where we're at. Well, now, Amazon Prime gives Vamp a 4.5 out of 5 stars out of 887 reviews. So that's pretty solid. I think if we were to split the difference between that one's almost equally split over there, at Rotten Tomatoes, and then what, 4.5, 5 stars here? I think you could give Vamp an even 4 out of 5 stars. Say 4 out of 5 stars. Pretty solid. Not bad. Not bad. So there we go. It has recouped, and ultimately the concept was vindicated. The concept was justified and vindicated. We saw that 10 years later with From Dusk Till Dawn, where we saw that Venus flytrap strategy of unsuspecting people walking into a den full of vampires actually play out and get the kind of reviews, or rather the kind of box office that obviously take into account for inflation that they would have expected back then when they were pulling the star power of someone like Grace Jones to their movie. And I'm sure that's what they were banking on, which I guess back then probably would have been somewhere in the neighborhood of what? Just off the top of my head, I'd say 10 million, 15 million. The box office, they probably would have expected something around that. They invested, what did we say, 3.3 million? So yeah, maybe 15. That might have been high. I don't know. We're talking about the 80s. Maybe 15 million. And that's guess what they would have expected. So there you go. Vamp would be ultimately vindicated. And here we are as horror aficionados. And I remember seeing Vamp as part of a triple horror feature at the Capitol Theater in Philadelphia. I had to be maybe 14, 15 years old. If anyone here hears this out of Philadelphia, you know, Capitol Theater was located past that graveyard on Girard Avenue. If you were coming from, and I don't know if that area was still been considered West Philadelphia. I was really young, but I remember you had to walk past that graveyard. That graveyard had to span a couple blocks, and it was located on the left side, which was fine when you were going in the daytime. But after sitting in a triple horror feature or double horror feature, and then you're coming back in the middle of the night, the graveyard's on your right hand side. You're walking past this graveyard. It's got to be, I'd swear that graveyard had to be 2, maybe 3 blocks long. At least it seemed to be that way as a kid. It was just monstrous. I mean, just gigantic. And I mean, it's pitch black and you're coming out of a triple horror feature at 1 or 2 in the morning and you're walking past that graveyard. Let me tell you, that was a long walk home. All right. So let's learn a little about Vamp's humble beginnings. Now, Don P. Borchers was a young executive working for Avco Embassy when he was introduced to Richard Wank, who was fresh off the success of his critically acclaimed short film, Dracula Bites the Big Apple. The two would go on to form a partnership, deciding to apply their creative talents to the development of a comedy horror. That idea, however, was quickly shot down by the studios, believing it was much easier to recreate the success of a horror comedy like the previous year's smash hit, The Reanimator, than it was trying to strike out in a new direction. Now, in this host's opinion, if they were concerned regarding the success of a comedy horror, they needn't look any further than another film released in 1985 that also featured the living dead and the fate of those turned by their infectious bite. That would be 1985's... anybody? That's right, The Return of the Living Dead. Now, as Borchers would most famously tell it, he was driving home on the LA freeway when he was struck by the name Vamp. As Wank would tell it, by the time Borchers got to him, he already had a poster, the name, and the three key elements: college students, vampires, and strippers. He would go on to tell Wank that if he could combine those three elements into a script, that he could direct it. It would take Richard Wank a few months and a stroke of genius to give us one of the four pillars of the greatest vampire films ever created in horror history. Instead of college students, vampires, and strippers, Vamp would become college students and vampire strippers. Let's listen in.
I thought of the title. It just struck me one day. I had a long drive home every night from work, and I thought, vampires, vamp, stripper, vampires, and I just saw the title, Vamp. It rang like a bell to me. And I said, that's going to be our movie. It's going to be called Vamp, Stripper Vampires.
Donald Borchers, the producer, came to me and with a title called Vamp and said that he would love to make a movie with this title, and that I could put together these three elements, a vampire, a stripper, and a couple college kids, I could direct it. I told Don I asked him what the story was, and he said, "Oh, you come up with that. I got the title. I can sell that." So I spent about 2 months trying to figure out a way to combine these three bizarre elements, and ended up coming up with the premise we have now, which is basically something that happens in one night.
So now, set with the script, they were off and running. Now, right from the onset, Don P. Borchers felt that the role of club manager was perfect for Jerry Lewis. And that actually would have been something to see. I mean, if you watch the movie now, and you watch how Sandy Baron, and he plays it excellently, most excellently, plays that role, and you grew up in the era where you're familiar with Jerry Lewis' work. I am. I'm 50. I remember a lot of his roles, and that actually would have been quite interesting to watch Jerry Lewis play that role. Perhaps someone will give us a deep fake one day on YouTube. But anyway, so Borchers felt right off the bat that Jerry Lewis was perfect for that role. Of course, that was also kicked out by someone in marketing who felt that Jerry Lewis at the time would have been a negative box office draw. So on a flip, they decide to play up the vampire angle and settle on, well, they actually hadn't settled on Grace Jones. Her name was on a list of several candidates, including Tina Turner. Now, anyone that remembers Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, that would have been something to see. Anyway, let's listen in as Don P. Borchers and director Richard Wank discuss what it was like to come up with the idea to cast Grace Jones.
The director and I were just totally excited when we found out that we could get Jerry Lewis in our film. We were shocked when the head of foreign sales told us that he was a negative box office element. You got to go with sales when you got to go with sales, and in this time we had to go with sales. So we cast that part down and cast the vampire part up and went for Grace Jones.
We had been talking about Tina Turner and Bianca Jagger at the time, and someone, Grace's name came up. It just sort of was a light bulb. It was actually the best idea of all.
Now, getting Grace was no small achievement because I didn't want to contact her and have her say, "I just did a view for Killing Conan. Why do I want to do a low-budget movie for New World Pictures?" So I called up people who were within my sphere of getting and wanted to assemble the top team that I could assemble. So I put this fabulous team together before I call up Grace. And it really talked her into doing the movie.
Now, the first-rate team the Borchers would bring together in an effort to convince Grace Jones to join the cast would be Oscar-winning special effects artist Greg Cannon, who had taken home the Academy Award the year before for his work on the movie Cocoon. Darwin Benjamin would serve on stunts, and Elliot Davis as director of photography. Now, it should be noted that due to a tragedy in Davis' family, Steve Barnum, who was the number one DP in the world at that time, would step in and film on Vamp for an entire week. Alan Roderick Jones would serve as production designer. And actually notes on the special edition DVD that he was present when world-renowned artist Keith Haring actually painted that chair that Grace Jones performs her striptease on. So with a team like that in place, Borchers reaches out to get Grace Jones. But there's an old saying that goes, be careful what you wish for. And unbeknownst to Borchers, he's getting ready to do that one thing that's going to set the stage to supersize his order for the entire Grace Jones experience. Now, in her defense, we all know those types of people, those dynamic personalities, larger than life. Everything they do has to be bigger than big. But also with those kind of personalities, you give them an inch. Listen, any other set of circumstances, any other actress, this would have went off without a hitch. But we're talking about Grace Jones. Let's go.
The Anne Rice book, Interview with a Vampire, it's got a lot of notoriety around, particularly the Hollywood area. It's been through some of the greatest directors, producers, screenwriters, optioned by some of the most talented filmmakers. It's a classic story of vampirism that's never been made. And I thought it would be a very interesting piece of material to put her into the right framework for her character.
to help her explore her motivations so she could, you know, make her character choices.
Well, when Don sent me the book to read, I think, Interview with the Vampire, and I read that book, and I was just totally blown away. It was just so intense, and I thought that if I could, you know, create that kind of a vampire, you know, one with memories and feelings and, you know, just not give it the same dimension as all the other vampires, just with the teeth and that's it, you know, no kind of background or history. So Katrina does have a history, I mean, and in the book Interview with the Vampire, there was such a storyline, you know, which made it really interesting.
Now, while we were doing the movie, she thought that she should stay in character, which meant that she became nocturnal.
Oh, wait a minute. Let's listen to that again.
Which meant that she became nocturnal, which meant that even when we were on the soundstage, she was refusing day calls. And she wasn't refusing it by having a dialogue saying, I've seen that you're trying to call me in during the day tomorrow. This is something we need to talk about. I'm trying to stay in care. She was refusing the call by not coming to set. Well, we were quickly falling behind schedule because we were having very difficult problems getting Grace to appear on set, just to get her to take a call. So I hired a production assistant with a beeper who was her 24-hour person who loved the opportunity to do this. We negotiated a sum of money for her to be working with Grace, kind of like the way a nanny works with a family. That was the approach that we took with this. And she didn't have any duties and responsibilities other than to be with Grace. And that way we always could find Grace. And it was important to be able to find Grace because during pre-production, she went to Paris without telling us so that she could do a fashion show with Isai Miyake. Now, in recompense for that, he made, by hand, Isai Miyake, made triples that we could use for the finale where she's killed and the blood and everything. And those are all handmade by Isai Miyake. So, I mean, he was a great guy about it, but imagine me thinking, why is Greg Canham calling me saying Grace didn't show up for makeup today? And then finding out that she's in Paris. And when she calls, she said, naturally, I knew you wouldn't mind. Grace, this is me. I mind.
Now, we promised you that this story is going to get crazy. And here at The Last Late Show, we don't disappoint. But it's only fair that we set the stage for what you're getting ready to hear. The year is 1986. Miami Vice is the hottest thing on television. Pastel colors and canvas shoes are in. So is big hair, dating Colombian drug lords, and cocaine.
At the top of the showbiz headlines, this late-breaking story, Victoria Sellers, daughter of the late film star Peter Sellers, and the subject of a Playboy magazine photo layout this month, is wanted for arrest. She's charged with belonging to a violent Hollywood-based cocaine trafficking ring. Federal prosecutors say the ring used violence and threats of violence. At the top of the showbiz headlines, Victoria Sellers surrendered today to Drug Enforcement Administration officers in Newark, New Jersey. The 23-year-old model and actress and five other Californians were indicted Wednesday on charges of participating in a cocaine ring. Sellers, who appears nude in the April issue of Playboy, is the daughter of Peter Sellers and Britt Eklund. Her manager and boyfriend is accused of being the mastermind of a cocaine ring. Prosecutors say Sellers lured a rival cocaine dealer into a meeting with her
Grace
boyfriend.
And we're about the fourth weekend, and we've changed the whole company so that even though we're on a soundstage, and even though we're working inside, we take a call around 5 o'clock at night, and we're playing ball with her as best we can, but she still hasn't shown up. She's not there. So the completion guarantor says to me, "This is your fault. You have to get her." I said, "Listen, I'm going to produce this show and I'm going to stay on budget by hook or by crook, but don't you be telling me that her conduct is my fault." I said, I've got the keys to her house, which I'm now going to get in my car and use. I've got a PA on a beeper who I'm going to make sure that I'm going to the right place. And so I go up to her house, which is not that far from the set. She's staying in the Hollywood Hills, and we're shooting at the old Ren Mar in just south of Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. And I knock on the door, and the Asian chap that would be her personal chef opens the door, and he's making her dinner. And come on in. You want to have some dinner? You know, you want to. I'd like to get Grace and go to the set. You know, we got a whole company waiting. Be good if she'd come to work. And there's Grace, and she goes, Donald, good to see you. So Grace, we got to go to work. She goes, let me just jump and take a quick shower, and we'll be off to work. So okay. I mean, that makes sense. She's taking the shower. Out of the shower comes a young woman who I've never met before who's drying her hair. Her name's Victoria Sellers. She's Peter Sellers' daughter. There's a television on, and the news happens to be on television. And I see on television a picture of Victoria Sellers. And they're talking about the FBI's 10 most wanted. Apparently, Victoria has chosen to have a boyfriend who is a drug dealer and not small time. And the reason she's with Grace right now is, as she's put it, trying to lay low. There's a lot of heat on her. I said, of course there's a lot of heat on you. You're one of the FBI's 10 most wanted people. I'm watching the TV. So I go to the phone, and I say to Victoria, there's really only two choices here. You're either going to call the FBI right now, and I'm going to watch you do it, or I'm going to call the FBI right now, and you're going to watch me do it. Because we really don't have a third choice, because I now have seen this, and I've seen you, and these are really our only two options. So Grace gets to the set about an hour later than we all hoped that day.
So there it is. We promised and we delivered the craziest backlot story you've ever heard. And you heard it here tonight on the first edition of The Last Late Show. Now, there's another version of that story that Borchers tells, where he goes to the house with the completion guarantor and actually finds Grace Jones and Victoria Sellers in the bed with another actor from the set of Vamp and the actor's brother. Now, I'm sure somewhere in there, there's the complete version of that story. Now, that one can be found on the Life, Legacy, and Legend of Don P. Borchers on YouTube right now. And you can hear the complete version of that story. And Grace Jones is throwing lamps and she's hitting people, and it just gets crazy. So there you are. You heard it here first. We're very proud to have produced this first episode of The Last Late Show. And we thought it was only right that we'd start with something of that magnitude. So there you go. Once again, my name's Jonathan Rain. We're going to close out here with a few upcoming horror cons. So beginning with those horror cons, this is going to cover the end of October leading into the first week of November. Now we have the Frightmare in the Falls going on October 28th to the 29th in Niagara Falls Convention Center, Ontario, Canada. Followed by the HalloCon, October 28th to the 30th, the O'Connell Lodge in Dalton, Georgia. Now, the Windsor Comic-Con takes place October 29th to October 30th at the St. Clair College Center for the Arts in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. And the Astronomicon, November 4th to November 6th at the Ritz Inn and Conference Center in West Henrietta, New York. And last but not least, we're going to finish this off with the Horrorpalooza weekend, November 4th to November 6th at the Waverly Hill Sanatorium in Louisville, Kentucky. Now, that sounds like something I'd like to go to. Maybe one day. So there it is, the first ever movie monster mashup from the first edition of The Last Late Show. Hopefully we'll see you here next week, and we'd like to bid you all a good night.